From KUAZ, Arizona Public Media, I'm Mark McLemore, and this is Arizona Spotlight. Coming up on today's show, Claudine LaMonaco brings us the story of some teenage refugees who resettled in Tucson. They created a photo project about their experience and went to Washington to speak out on behalf of refugees around the world. I talked to native Tucsonan David Baker. He recently traveled the length of the Arizona Trail, hiking from one side of our state to the other. He'll reflect on the experience. Tony Paniagua takes a look at the bottled water industry and the impact it's having on both the economy and the environment. And Christopher Conover interviews Barry Goldwater Jr. about his new book, co-written with John Dean, about the political legacy of his father. That's all coming up next on Arizona Spotlight. Today is International Refugee Day, a time to stop and consider the plight of millions of people around the world who are forced to flee their homes. Each year, the U.S. opens its doors to around 60,000 refugees, people who have been persecuted due to their race, nationality, religion, or political beliefs. Around 500 to 600 of them are resettled in Tucson. Recently, a group of Tucson's youngest refugees traveled to Washington, D.C. for the opening of an exhibit at the U.S. Senate featuring photographs they took as students in the Catalina High School ESL program. Claudine LaMonaco caught up with one student to hear her story.
18-year-old Hawa Bello stands behind the counter at Burger King, taking orders all day long. To most customers, Hawa probably appears like an average American teenager, her hair done up in a cascade of braids piled atop her head, a zebra print-covered cell phone hanging off her back pocket.
Whopper Juniors, no mayo, and mustard.
With cheese or without?
If they are careful listeners, customers might detect a slight accent in her voice.
Two Whopper Juniors, no mayonnaise, and mustard.
Two senior citizen drinks.
But Hawa is far from average. Hawa's a Liberian refugee. She came to Tucson 2.5 years ago. Before that, all she'd known was war. She was born in Liberia's capital, Monrovia, in 1990, just 6 months after the start of the country's civil war. She was a premature baby and should have stayed in the hospital, but war came to the capital the day after she was born, and she and her mother had to flee.
That's why my mom named me Hawa, because it means lucky child. I didn't stay in hospital to get the medication I deserve as a premature. It was just by God's grace, and she said that I survived.
Her mother took Hawa and ran through the Liberian forests looking for safety. It wasn't easy.
Sometimes no water to drink because you can't go to the nearest creek and drink because you might find rebels there.
Liberian rebels killed Hawa's father when she was just a baby, so she has no memories of him. She and her mother spent years fleeing the rebels. Getting caught could mean death or life as a child soldier. Hawa says not everyone was as lucky as she was to escape.
I have friends that lost their parents and that fought during the war. Some of them had to shoot their parents in the head because they were instructed to.
Hawa, her mother, and little brother bounced around refugee camps in countries all over Western Africa before her mother was able to send her and her little brother to a camp in Nigeria with her uncle when she was 12. Each country meant learning a new language and new customs. Hawa has a large scar on her right arm from what happened on her first day of school in Nigeria.
The teacher walked in, we greeted him. Somehow he asked something, but he spoke Yoruba. I didn't speak Yoruba then. He asked something, and all I could see was all of them pointing at me. He called my name, I came out, and just started on me. He's like, beat me up, and I was bleeding. I cried. Just wipe your tears because there's nothing you can do about it. It's their school policy.
After 2 years in Nigeria, her uncle was granted refugee status in the United States. The U.S. isn't the perfect country she dreamed of. She was shocked to learn the country had homeless people and a serious drug problem. And her mother is still stuck in Liberia. But Hawa says the United States has given her tremendous opportunity and a chance to fulfill her dreams.
Hi. What can I get for you today?
A medium chocolate shake.
That'll be all for you today?
Burger King is a job to help support her family. But Hawa, an honor student at Catalina High School, plans to go to med school after college at the U of A. During her junior year at Catalina, Hawa participated in a special project to study photography and writing with her ESL class. A couple weeks ago, six of the students, a mix of immigrants and refugees, traveled to Washington, D.C. for the opening of an exhibit of their photographs in the U.S. Senate. While there, they also told their stories and advocated on behalf of other immigrants and refugees at a congressional briefing. Hawa said that back in the refugee camp, she never could have imagined that soon she would be addressing U.S. congressmen. Kelly Naffy, who works with the Lutheran Refugee Resettlement Program, helped start the photo project at Catalina High.
This program gives youth the opportunity to express their voice and to explore their own voice, their own thoughts about the resettlement process, about what they've gone through as refugees, and what they've gone through here, coming to the United States, learning about their new community, figuring out who they are, not only as teenagers, but as teenagers that have been through some pretty tremendous experiences.
Photos from other students like Hawa can also be seen at bus stops throughout Tucson. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Claudine LaMonaco.
My next guest, David Baker, recently went for a walk, one just a little more ambitious than many of us would attempt. He hiked from one side of Arizona to the other, following a path called the Arizona Trail. Its winding route led him over almost 800 miles of terrain, including desert and mountains, with everything in between. I spoke with David Baker about the trip and what led him to hike the Arizona Trail.
I first got excited about it nearly 10 years ago, I think. I met a hiker in the Rincon Mountains in Happy Valley Saddle, and we stopped and chatted for a few moments. I asked him where he was going that day, and he said, well, I'm going to Utah. I'm hiking the Arizona Trail. At that time, the Arizona Trail, I think, had been in existence for maybe 10 years already. The trail's 20 years old right now. But that was the time where I got excited about getting on it after talking to this man from New York.
What's the origin of the Arizona Trail itself?
A Flagstaff teacher named Dale Shewalter was and is the inspiration for the trail, and I believe that he conceived the idea way back in the 1970s and the late 70s. In the mid-80s, the first section of trail was dedicated, and in the 20 years since then, mostly volunteers have been working at it, routing it, building it, and as of today, I think they're only about 11 or 12 or 15 miles short of having a trail that's complete from border to border.
What kind of experience do you have with the outdoors?
Well, I was born and raised in Tucson. I run an outdoor store here, the Summit Hut, and we have two locations. And I've been interested in the outdoors, backpacking, hiking, and climbing ever since I was a teenager. I've been active ever since then. I spent most of my 20s and early 30s rock climbing, but in the last 15 or 20 years, I've had a renewed interest in hiking and backpacking all over the state.
How long did you expect the hike to take?
Well, there's a lot of ways to do the Arizona Trail. Many people do it in sections and spread the hike out over years. They might do a day hike of a section or a one or two night backpack. I was interested in doing the trail more or less continuously. And because of some sort of scheduling issues on my business calendar, I hope to do the trail in around 50, 55 days or so. And that's how it ended up working out. I started off from the Mexican border on March 22nd, and I got up to the Utah border May 15th. So I was gone about 55 days, I think, is the count I had. And I rested or wasn't walking for 17 of those days.
Were you planning on making this hike alone?
Originally, yes. Friends, family, my wife, my parents expressed a little anxiety about me spending that whole time alone. So it turned out that I was put together with a tax attorney from Phoenix, also interested in doing the hike this spring. And we met each other through the Arizona Trail Association. The director of that organization is called Dave Hicks. He ended up being a common contact, told each of us that we were each thinking of doing the hike, and we got together, enjoyed each other's company, and we spent the first 3 weeks of the trail with each other, hiking together. Halfway through the trip, at the end of the third week, I had to return home with my family. My mother-in-law passed away during that time, and I spent about 10 days off the trail being with the family. And Terry, my partner for the first half, was anxious to do the hike uninterrupted, and he kept going. And when I got back on the trail, 10 or 11 days after we parted company, I was alone for the rest of the trip. I enjoyed both sections of the trip immensely. Terry was a great partner. I learned a lot from him. He had previous through hiking experience, and we were very compatible. being alone for that amount of time and walking long distances sort of under the clear sky with nothing but your own thoughts to occupy your mind, I found it quite nice. I enjoyed that too.
And what was your morale like during the trip? After a few days, did you think that you bitten off a little more than you could chew?
I like to hike. I really enjoy it. And I enjoy walking uphill, downhill, flat. Doesn't really matter to me. I really enjoy doing it. So I think for the most part, my morale was really, really good. I woke up most every day really raring to go and would usually start walking right at sunrise and just keep walking until sunset most days. Like most hikers on trips that long, I had a few challenges, blisters. I had shin splints for a week during the trip, sort of had to work through those issues, and you have to sort of be patient and allow yourself to heal. But it all worked out fine.
And what kind of terrain does the Arizona Trail cut through?
Empty, beautiful, tremendous variety. In southern Arizona, you've got the mix of Sky Island ranges down south here, miles and miles of big desert basins north of the Catalinas, north of the town of Oracle. The Rim Country, Mogollon Rim, the big Ponderosa Pine Plateaus, water, lakes, streams, the San Francisco Peaks, the Grand Canyon. And then finally, the approach to the Colorado Plateau when you're approaching the Red Sandstone Country up in the very far northern part of the state. It's fantastic.
Did this journey inspire you to see Arizona in a new light?
Absolutely. I really thought before the trip started that I would be perhaps jaded in some sections, particularly the desert sections. I've grown up in Tucson, so I feel or felt very familiar with the desert.
Yeah, you've seen one desert.
You've seen them all. But I can't tell you how many days in the southern part of the state in the deserts I just stopped dead in my tracks, looked around and went, wow, this is beautiful.
Well, you said at one point that you could sometimes go for 4 days without seeing anyone out in the open. When people did see you, were they surprised? Did they wonder what you were doing? And how many times did people ask if you were lost?
Well, no one asked me if I was lost. a few people remarked, you would usually have conversation. Hey, what are you doing? And they'd tell you and they'd ask you what you were doing and you'd tell them. And the people that knew about the Arizona Trail, I think, were more envious than surprised. I mean, gee, I hope I can do that someday. And folks that didn't know about the Arizona Trail really were surprised that there was a trail that traversed the entire state. I have to say that it amused me, but that many days in a row alone left with my own thoughts. Sometimes when I stumbled across another person and had conversation, I found myself kind of tongue-tied. It took a while to get the tongue going and to sort of relearn how to talk fluently again.
So we've talked about the people that you encountered on your trip. What about the wildlife?
Well, at the pace that I was generally walking, I found it really wasn't conducive to observing wildlife because you kind of have your head down a little bit and you're just working all day long to make progress along the trail. But having said that, I saw lots of wildlife. And something that particularly delighted me was up in the Rim Country near Flagstaff, I must have seen 100, 150 elk over the course of a week or so up there. Antelope, golden eagles, California condors, all kinds of reptiles, rattlesnakes, lizards, and so forth, foxes, coyotes, deer.
Any close encounters?
Oh, no. Other than I think I got nervous one night in my tent alone in a really quiet, quiet, deep night up on the rim. And I was woken up 11 o'clock or midnight by this cry way out in the forest. It was quite a piercing, haunting cry. And I really thought at first that it might be a mountain lion. I wasn't scared exactly, but I became alert. But after a few more sounds from this animal, I realized it was nothing but a screech owl. Rolled over and went back to sleep.
If you'd like to read more about David's Arizona Trail adventure, we've got a link to both his blog and to the Arizona Trail Association. They're online at KUAZ.org. We'll have more Arizona Spotlight for you right after this break. In 2006, bottled water sales in the United States surpassed 8 billion gallons, which is more than any other beverage except for carbonated soft drinks. In developing countries, the demand for bottled water is driven by the lack of safe drinking water, but the reasons for its popularity in the U.S. are more complex. Tony Paniagua reports.
Bottled water is a multi-billion dollar a year business in this country, but there's growing concern about the impact of this industry on our planet. Opponents say there are hidden costs you should think about before taking a drink.
There's a tremendous amount of waste in the production and the transport of the bottles, and then the bottles themselves just being thrown away in the landfills.
Kevin Burke is a graduate student at the University of Arizona, and he also works for the Campus Sustainability Committee. He's doing outreach to inform the community about this habit, which is considered good for the body, but detrimental to the environment. Here are some figures for the United States in 2006. More than 25 billion plastic water bottles were sold. Not counting the transportation to get them to market, more than 17 million barrels of oil were necessary for their production, and 2.5 million tons of carbon dioxide were produced as a result.
They're made of oil. It takes oil and energy to produce them, and it actually also takes a lot of water to produce them. For an average bottle of water, it takes about 3 liters of water to make that bottle.
There's also the garbage to think about. Billions of glass and plastic bottles are not recycled, so they end up in landfills or as litter in our surroundings. That's why Burke and a growing number of people around the country are promoting regional tap water. It's a much better choice, they say, if you care about the planet.
It's so easy to get water from the tap, and we've all been paying taxes for years. We have the infrastructure in place, and actually most Americans have the cleanest and best tap water in the world. So really there's not a good reason except that some people maybe buy the idea that it's more convenient to buy a bottle of water. There's actually a very small difference between tap water and bottled water, if any. Most of the bottled water sources actually come from municipal tap water supplies.
Warren Tenney is the Assistant General Manager for Metro Water District north of Tucson, which serves about 45,000 people in unincorporated Pima County. The public water provider also encourages tap water and stop bottling its own water, which used to be handed out at different events.
Unfortunately, we realized over time that we were inadvertently promoting bottled water, and that was not the best thing to be doing for the environment as well as for promoting tap water. We go through a lot of requirements based on EPA's Safe Drinking Water Standard Act that requires much more testing of the water at your tap than what bottled water goes through.
Back at the university, Burke is conducting taste tests between tap and bottled water, but convincing consumers may prove to be quite challenging. Making the switch to tap water may be hard to swallow for some people.
Tap water, I will not drink it. It's really gross to me. It kind of makes me gag. But I usually buy filtered water from the water stores and stuff rather than buying bottled water to try to save, you know, from excess plastics and stuff.
I try to be as environmentally friendly as I can, but I think that's my biggest weakness is buying bottled water. I'm a Dasani lover. It tastes better. It's easy. It's so convenient. I just take it anywhere with me. Taking tap water is so much harder. You have to clean your bottles and you have to fill it and constantly filter it, and it's not as cold, and so it's just easier, I guess.
Even if you're not that concerned about the environment, you may want to consider drinking tap water to help out your pocketbook, and we have three examples with European bottled water that we bought at a local supermarket. Evian from France is 1 liter for $1.79. Panna from Italy is a half a liter for $1.89. And this glass of water is from Norway. It's called Vaz, and it costs $1.99 for 12.6 ounces. This one from Norway is the most expensive at nearly 16 cents per ounce.
At Metro Water District, for a little over $2, you get 1,000 gallons of water. So you can do the math comparing with what you buy at the store with bottled water, and you can see that tap water is quite the economical benefit.
It's a huge difference in price, and tap water supporters say that's only the beginning, so they hope more bottled water consumers reconsider their actions. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Tony Paniagua.
Barry Goldwater Jr. is a former member of the U.S. House of Representatives, where he represented California as a Republican from 1969 to 1983. His father was the 5-term Arizona Senator Barry Goldwater, who is credited with restarting the conservative movement in American politics during the 1960s. He also ran against Lyndon Johnson for the presidency in 1964. In a new book, Barry Goldwater Jr. explores his father's political legacy, as we'll hear next in this conversation with Christopher Conover.
A new book, Pure Goldwater, gives readers a private look at Senator Barry Goldwater through his own writings. The book was compiled by his son, Barry Goldwater Jr., who joins us in the studio now. Thanks so much for coming in.
You forgot to mention the co-author, John Dean.
And you two are lifelong friends, and John Dean is a bit of history in his own right.
John and I went to high school together. We were on the swimming team together. And then later on, we met in Washington, D.C., where I was a member of Congress. And John was legal counsel to President Nixon, who he later had to testify against in the Watergate hearings. And here we are back again, bringing forth the wisdom of Senator Barry Goldwater, my father.
Let's talk about this book. It chronicles his life, but not just politics. There's a whole chapter about his journal writings on a 1939 trip around Arizona. We get a real personal look at your dad.
Well, there was a lot of biographies written about my father, but this one was written by him. John and I just happened to discover these diaries. There were diaries, journals that he kept sporadically, but pretty reliably throughout his 60 years in public office. And it does start out with his trips up through northern Arizona into the Indian countries, where he kept very accurate records of what he was seeing and what he was feeling, but he also recorded it with photography. And he is known as a very fine photographer and has published about 3 photographic books. He took pictures of the Indians that aren't there today.
One of the letters was that's in the book is from 1943. He wrote it while he was in the military, and he wrote it to you, and you were, I guess, about 5 years old, and you'd written him a letter about a run-in with a rattlesnake, and he had some advice for dealing with rattlesnakes, and then he also makes the connection between Hitler and rattlesnakes.
You know, that was so long ago, I'm not sure I remember it, but as told to me, I was running around the house yelling, Heil Hitler. And somehow or another he found out about it, and later we found out that what was his friend George, who was a bird. And on these letters that he would write us was a picture of an airplane with George the bird sitting out on the wing. And he would write his kids and say, now George told me that you were misbehaving. Now son, when I'm not here, you're the man of the house. And those kinds of things. And the Heil Hitler, he compared to a rattlesnake and being very dangerous, and be careful about that. We kill those kinds of creatures. And he admonished me that that was not proper. But those were beautiful letters that are really for another book, another time, and all about George. We could hardly wait to get a hold of that bird. We were going to smash him because he was telling on us.
Talking about your relationship with your dad, there is a journal entry that was written on the occasion of your parents' 50th wedding anniversary, and he recounts some wonderful tales about their honeymoon in Mexico. And towards the end of it, the one thing he said was, in his words, he was a lousy dad, and he hoped to be a better grandfather. You can obviously be the judge of him as a father and a grandfather. That's a tough self-assessment from someone.
Well, I know it is, and he was hard on himself in that regard. You can only be in one place at a time. And when he was in the Second World War, he was gone for 4 years. And we didn't see him. And then he came back, and he went into the family business in Phoenix for maybe 10 years, and then ran for the city council. And then in 1952, he was off to Washington, D.C. as a United States senator. So again, we didn't see him. I think it probably was as hard on him as it was on us. Your kids always want to have a dad around for that discipline, for that fatherly advice. This is one reason my father wrote the book Pure Goldwater, or wrote the journal, which became Pure Goldwater. And in the first page that he wrote this, he wrote why he wrote it. He said, just in case I'm not here, I want this journal to be much like a hand to a drowning man, to give you the wisdom, the benefit of my experiences and advice. And that's what started him in writing that the year I was born.
We're getting short on time, but let's talk about your dad and his relevance today. This book is still relevant today. You're watching the presidential race today. How does all of this tie together?
Well, history does, it does repeat itself. In 1964, when my father ran for president of the United States against Lyndon Johnson, it was, as it is today, a conservative against a liberal. And the people have to decide what kind of government do they want. They want people, they want a government that's less intrusive, that gives you more personal freedom, or do they want a government who's going to do things for you all the time and take your tax money to pay for it? And we have the classic contest today, just like we had then. And my father's slogan when he ran in 1964 was, "A choice, not an echo." So you have that same kind of thing. And it's relevant today because if you read this book, you find out what a statesman is all about. Who is somebody that is honest, is respected for his integrity, who is liked by both sides of the aisle, and who was a leader in his own right. And I think Americans are looking for leadership today.
The book is Pure Goldwater by John Dean and Barry Goldwater Jr. Thank you so much for coming in.
And now here's the Arizona Spotlight Arts Calendar with Stephanie Varney.
Today, the Dunbar Museum and Cultural Center will be hosting a cultural festival and potluck. Nations including Burma, Somalia, Iraq, and Sudan will be represented with music, food, dancing, and handmade crafts. Participants are asked to bring a potluck dish from their own cultural heritage. The festival starts at 6:30 p.m. and is located at 200 West 2nd Street. The Arizona Sonora Desert Museum is opening a new exhibit called Beyond Visions of Planetary Landscapes, showcasing portraits of our solar system's diverse planetary and lunar landscapes. The exhibit runs through July 13th, and desertmuseum.org has more information. Reed Park's DeMeester Outdoor Performance Center and Shakespeare Under the Stars present The Merry Wives of Windsor. There are three free shows this weekend at 8 p.m., and the Performance Center is located at 22nd Street and Country Club. Also, tickets for the UA Presents 2008-2009 season are now on sale, including shows by Katie Lang, the Golden Dragon Acrobats, and more. Tickets for some shows are selling out fast. Contact uapresents.org to make reservations. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Stephanie Varney.
That's Arizona Spotlight for this week. Thank you for listening. Arizona Spotlight is a production of KUAZ Radio, Arizona Public Media, and is produced in the KUAZ studios by Jim Blackwood, with assistance from Stephanie Varney. Our executive producer is Peter Michaels. The music heard on our program, including the theme, is written and performed by Calexico. Podcasts of Arizona Spotlight are available online at KUAZ.org. I'm Mark McLemore.